Mostly cloudy tonight, patchy fog late, lows 54 to 61, and tomorrow, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, mostly sunny.
It doesn't have a lot of legal oomph to it, a lot of legal teeth. I think it's going to be more symbolic than real.
A new executive order from President Trump could fundamentally change how children in the U.S. get vaccinated.
It's Tuesday, August 11th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Washington Post reports that President Trump secretly flew in a smaller plane after the NATO summit.
This was despite claims by the White House that he boarded Air Force One.
The president walked up the external steps to the old Air Force One and then almost immediately walked off the plane onto an airport catering truck.
Also in Puerto Rico, the government has started rationing water,
which means that homes are going without water on a rotating schedule.
To not have water, it's like a handicap. I feel like there's nothing I can do.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. New reporting contradicts what the White House told press traveling with President Trump during a recent trip to Turkey. NPR's Tamara Keith reports that may have left reporters vulnerable.
President Trump boarded Air Force One as usual, but the Washington Post reports he was then smuggled off the plane in a catering truck and flew on an entirely different aircraft. NPR hasn't confirmed the report, but journalists and White House aides who unknowingly flew on the decoy plane were firmly instructed to keep their window shades lowered. Later, talking to reporters, Trump never let on.
Were you aware of any credible threat by Iran against Air Force One?
Well, I have a threat all the time. I'm number one on their list. Before you. But if I go, you go. Right?
But was there a specific
perhaps someday you want to change professions.
Tamara Keith, NPR News.
It's been a year since President Trump deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C. Some worry it's normalizing armed uniformed troops in American cities in non-emergency situations. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
President Trump declared a crime emergency in D.C. last August, despite violent crime being at a 30-year low, and deployed the National Guard. Since then, the number of armed troops patrolling the city has gone from around 800 to nearly 5,000 from more than 20 different states. Despite that, there has been a 3% increase in violent crime in the past year, according to city police data. Opportunistic crimes like theft and vehicle break-ins have continued to decrease. Trump has repeatedly touted the deployment as a success, claiming falsely that there is, quote, almost no crime in D.C. now. The deployment currently has an estimated cost of around $3 million per day. It's been extended until Inauguration Day 2029. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
The University of Michigan says it will do away with grades for freshmen in the fall of 2027. Instead, first semester classes will be pass-fail. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports it's an effort to ease students' mental health struggles on campus.
The new pilot policy hopes to acclimate new students to the demands of college, allow exploration into different classes, and get students not to worry about how a low-grade freshman year might have long-term consequences. Other colleges, like the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, have similar grading policies for freshmen. How colleges grade students varies greatly. Reed College in Oregon records letter grades, but they're only shared with students upon request. At Harvard, faculty voted to give out fewer A grades to try and battle what they say is high grade inflation. All of this comes at a time that stress on campus remains quite high. In a 2024 survey, about 70% of college students reported struggling with mental health. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Arizona's Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs picked a Republican turned independent as her running mate in a tough re-election campaign. The ticket, with former Mesa Mayor John Giles, aims to appeal to Republicans and conservative independents in a state that was once a Republican stronghold. Giles, a critic of President Trump, has endorsed Democrats, including Kamala Harris, and his place on the ticket could attract Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints members, a key voting bloc. Many church members are ambivalent about Trump. In the Republican governor's race, the nominee is far-right Congressman Andy Biggs. Dogs might be able to read people's emotions by looking at their faces. That's according to a recent study in the journal iScience. NPR's Katie Riddle has more.
Previous studies have shown that dogs can broadly interpret human emotions, like happiness or sadness. This study looked at how well dogs can sense more subtle human feelings, like the difference between anger and fear or happiness and neutrality. Researchers trained dogs to sit still while they examined their brain activity through an MRI and showed them pictures of human faces. The test showed that the dogs registered different brain activity for these different emotions. Researchers used 14 dogs for this experiment. They point out that not all dogs may have this sophisticated emotional intelligence. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell, the Dow down 184, NASDAQ down 159. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock, you're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about their dinner menu at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Mostly cloudy tonight, patchy fog late, lows 54 to 61, and tomorrow high 77 to 81, mostly sunny. More news is next on KAXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The latest attempt by the Trump administration to overhaul the way American children get vaccinated is raising a lot of questions. The president wants to change the nationally recognized childhood vaccination schedule with an executive order that he signed yesterday. So we decided to turn to NPR health correspondent Rob Stein to get some answers. Hi, Rob. I hope you have answers.
Well, I'll give it my best.
Okay, so the president is demanding that the U.S. cut the number of vaccines that kids get to protect them from a bunch of dangerous infectious diseases, right? And also space out the shots more.
Right.
So does it change anything for parents walking into their pediatrician's office today?
Well, the short answer is not really. Okay. None of the recommendations from the government or anyone else has changed about, you know, which kids should get which shots when or anything else. All the same shots are still available. Insurance companies are still paying for them. A big government program is still providing shots for free for something like half of all U.S. kids. Dorit Rice is a vaccine policy and law expert at UC Law in San Francisco. I asked her about the president's latest executive order on vaccines.
It doesn't have a lot of legal oomph to it, a lot of legal teeth. I think it's going to be more symbolic than real.
Huh. That's because previous attempts by Trump and Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to make these kinds of changes were blocked by a federal judge, and that case is still winding its way through the courts. You know, that said, Elsa, the president is calling for some significant changes, and there could be some impact down the road.
Okay, let's talk about that potential impact. Can you just take a moment to lay out these proposed changes? What exactly does the president want to do, and why?
Well, Trump thinks there's a link between vaccines and autism. So he wants to reduce the number of vaccines recommended by the federal government from 17 to 11 uh-huh. and for states to require fewer shots for school. He also wants to space out the shots kids do get more by doing things like splitting up the MMR shot, which protects against measles, mumps, and rubella, into three separate vaccines.
But wait, would that work?
The problem there is that you can't get separate shots for those diseases in the U.S., and it would take years to make them available here.
Oh.
And there's plenty of evidence that all the shots are safe and are most effective the way they're given now. Any link to autism has been thoroughly debunked, and spacing out shots has lots of downsides. I talked about this with Dr. Aaron Carroll from Academy Health. That's a nonpartisan nonprofit health research group.
The reason we bunch them up together is to make it easier for kids so that you don't have to get as many pokes. But also requiring more visits to the doctor makes it less likely that people are going to finish them. But also they have to pay for those visits. Parents have to take time off work. There's no good reason to do this and tons of reason not to.
But the president just can't do something like that anyway, just by signing an executive order.
Okay. What about the part of the order that calls for making it easier for parents to opt out of school vaccination requirements? Like, can you say more about that?
Yeah, sure. The reality is that states, not the federal government, control that. And most states already let parents opt out for religious or other reasons. But Trump did order the Justice Department to pressure the handful of states that don't. So we'll have to see what comes of that. But the biggest effect of all this is that it sows more confusion and doubt among parents. And vaccine hesitancy has already been rising. Vaccination rates have already been falling. So if you have the president making headlines with lots of misinformation about vaccines, that can only make things worse by, you know, making parents more hesitant, which leads to more kids missing shots, more kids being left unprotected, and more kids getting sick.
That is NPR's Rob Stein. Thank you, Rob.
You bet, Elsa.
Let's move now to the war with Iran. The war appears to be stalling. So do the on and off efforts to end it. President Trump said earlier this week he was low-keying efforts to come to a deal. Iran said it wouldn't even talk to him until midterm elections in November. In related news, the president's recently announced peace deal for Gaza, which called for Hamas disarmament and Israel's withdrawal, was rejected by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Let's discuss all of this with NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, who's here in Washington, and NPR international correspondent Hadil Alshalchi, who is in Istanbul. Hi to both of you.
Hey, Juan.
Hello.
Hadil, I'll start with you. Iranians are in talks to open the Strait of Hormuz, just not with the U.S. Those talks are with Oman, which controls the southern shore of the waterway. What are the Iranians saying about these talks?
Well, first, Trump has said that the U.S. is involved in talks with Iran, but Iran has denied that. But both things could, in fact, be true because the talks are being carried out through intermediaries like Pakistan and Qatar. A Pakistani delegation was in Tehran today, and the Qatari Foreign Ministry said that the talks between Iran and its neighbor Oman, like you just said, who that lies across the Strait of Hormuz, have reached what it called an advanced stage and said they were at, quote, a critical juncture. Last week, the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said that until the U.S. makes amends for its attacks, there's no way they're going to go back to negotiations with Washington. But he said that talks with Oman were in their final stages and that Iran's demands were communicated to the U.S. via intermediaries. Now, the Iranians know they need to strike a deal eventually with the U.S., but they feel like they've been able to survive whatever the U.S. has thrown at them so far. And so now they're making sure that their demands are as maximalist as possible, and that will force negotiations to drag on for as long as possible.
Franco, two of President Trump's Middle East deals are unraveling. So what does that tell us about his credibility on the global stage?
Yeah, I think there are some common themes with both of those conflicts, or at least Trump's approach to them. I mean, he touts this major breakthrough that is supposed to bring historic peace, and yet peace doesn't actually happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, with Gaza, Trump declared a monumental step, you know, toward lasting peace, brokering an agreement where Israel would withdraw from Gaza and Hamas would give up their weapons. But like is so often in these cases, it comes down to the details. And the problem was that neither Hamas nor Israel wanted to go first. You know, similarly, Trump was touting last week that he would soon have an agreement to open the Strait of Hormuz, something he said many times. Yet again, the deal falls apart, and now Iran is saying they're going to stop negotiating. You know, in both of these cases, the president is presenting these things as, you know, buttoned-up deals. The problem is resolved when it's clearly not, and it really just makes it all so much harder to take Trump at his word. And that goes for world leaders, that goes for allies, adversaries. It also goes for financial markets and voters back home.
I have to say, Franco, this sort of reminds me of George W. Bush speaking on an aircraft carrier with a mission accomplished banner just weeks after the invasion of Iraq. Fair comparison?
You know, I think you're not the only one who's making that comparison. I mean, Trump has actually been claiming victory for months. I mean, here he is back in March at a rally in Kentucky.
You know, you never like to say too early you won. We won. We won the bet. In the first hour, it was over.
You know, and this week, even Trump's claiming that the U.S. and not Iran is in charge of the Strait of Hormuz.
The only one that has control of the Strait of Hormuz right now is the United States Navy. We have a blockade that's been infallible. It's a steel wall. And we let people in that we want to let in. And those people come in and they've been coming in and they're going out.
Juana, it's all just so far from reality. I mean, of course, this is kind of diplomacy is never clean. It's often evolving. But declaring premature victory and doing it so repeatedly, it is taking a toll on the U.S. reputation. I mean, a poll from just a few weeks ago by the Pew Research Center found that people across 20 countries view China more positively than the U.S.
Hadil, earlier, you mentioned some of Iran's maximalist demands. What are they asking for?
I mean, the list is long. First, Iran says it would only reopen the Strait of Hormuz if the U.S. lifted its naval blockade as well as sanctions. The U.S. military must withdraw from around Iran, pay reparations for war damages, release frozen Iranian assets, and end its attacks. And now in the deal that Iran wants to ban any U.S. or Israeli ships from moving through the strait and says that it will charge a fee on ships going through. Last week, Iranian Foreign Minister Araghchi said that the U.S. did this all to themselves by breaking that memorandum of understanding they reached in June.
Franco, Trump returned to office championing himself as the ultimate deal maker. It was such a big part of his foreign policy identity that he could do what other presidents could not. But have we seen evidence of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, he repeatedly would say that he knew just the right words. He knew just the right ways to strike deals on the world's biggest challenges, whether that was Iran, whether that was Gaza, or even Ukraine. I mean, we're now almost 6 months, though, into fighting with Iran, and there is no end in sight. A peace agreement was actually signed in Gaza 9 months ago, yet the fighting continues. Now, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed since then, the UN says. So much of Trump's style is to build around strength and the threat of unbelievable consequences. But now Iran is basically puffing out its chest and pressing Trump politically, and with the midterms ahead, trying to push them into more uncomfortable positions. I mean, it's really leading to another comparison to another president, President Jimmy Carter, and the Iran hostage crisis that helped lead to his political downfall. And that's not a comparison that Trump's going to like, especially Trump, since Trump has often mocked Carter's legacy.
Hadil, last thing, do we have any insight into what Iran's strategy is in all of this?
I mean, Franco mentioned the midterms. Iran is very aware of Trump's vulnerability going into the midterms. Iranian media, for example, is really keeping track of how Trump is polling. They know that they may not be able to beat the U.S. militarily, but they can drag this out, like I said. And they want to show that they are resilient and want to play a stronger hand than they normally would in the Hormuz negotiations. Iran has also said it may want to push nuclear talks further into the future, maybe up to 4 months from now, according to officials there. And those demands I just listed aren't really great for the U.S. Mm-hmm. So Iran wants to combine all of this to possibly force Trump to go into the midterms with no Iranian deal, a weak economy, and an angry base that is very much against the war.
NPR's Hadil El-Shalchi and NPR's Franco Ordonez, thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Juana.
In my mind, there's a fog. San Francisco.
And you're listening there to Death Cab for Cutie, performing at the Tiny Desk. The video just dropped today. Watch the whole concert in the music tab in the NPR app. Download it wherever you get your apps. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:18. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, Juana Summers speaks with Washington Post reporter Dan LaMoth. He will explain how President Trump recently departed Turkey on a military jet instead of Air Force One. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Today is primary election day in Minnesota, and our news team has been visiting the polls, and we'll have the results for you later tonight on a live blog at kaxe.org. And tune in tomorrow morning for results with Heidi Holton and Chelsea Perkins. Remember, polls in Minnesota are open until 8 p.m., and you can register at the polls if you have not done that yet. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy, patchy fog late with lows 54 to 61. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 77 to 81, light northwest wind. And for Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s. The Northern Minnesota Robotics Conference has a grand opening and ribbon cutting for the new North Star Center this Wednesday at 2 o'clock. This new science, technology, automation, and robotics center is located within the Beltrami County Fairgrounds in Bemidji. And tomorrow is the first day of the Beltrami County Fair that runs through Sunday in Bemidji. Other county fairs happening this week, it's the Carlton County Fair, August 13th through the 16th in Barnum, and Central St. Louis County Fair in Meadowlands this Friday through Sunday. You can find more area events going on this week at KAXC.org. Look for events up north.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox. From the world of Jane Austen in The Other Bennet Sister to the rolling Yorkshire hills in A Woman of Substance, BritBox is committed to helping viewers find their next escape. Streaming now at BritBox.com. From Schwab, where investors have a range of choices to pursue investing goals, from self-directed investing to full-service wealth management, all in one place. More at Schwab.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The scene of President Trump boarding Air Force One after last month's NATO summit in Turkey is one that TV cameras and photographers have captured countless times. However, what happened in the moments after that was far from routine. That is according to exclusive reporting from The Washington Post. The Post reports that Trump was shuttled in an airport catering truck to a smaller military plane in which he then secretly departed, even as the White House announced he was flying aboard Air Force One. The operation was prompted by an Iranian assassination threat, a U.S. official familiar with the operation told the Post. We should note that NPR has not independently confirmed this reporting. Dan Lamothe is one of the Washington Post reporters that broke this story, and he is with us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Dan, I mean, just walk us through this. Trump appears to get on Air Force One in Turkey, but tell us what actually happens next.
Right. So it's a kind of a multi-step process here. Trump flew to Turkey on the new Air Force One jet gifted by Qatar last year. Early in the day, he said that that plane was being sent back to Britain so troops there could see it. That raised a lot of red flags, even in the moment that maybe something was off. At the time, everyone was told that Trump would be taking the old Air Force One, mm-hmm. which is that powder blue and white plane that everybody's seen for years, to get back home. What actually happened is that the president walked up the external steps to the old Air Force One, waved to the cameras, and then almost immediately, we're told, walked off the plane on the opposite side of the aircraft onto an elevated airport catering truck, which is basically a truck where it almost has like an elevator in the back of it mm-hmm. that brings a shipping container up to the side of the plane. That truck then lowers back to ground level, drives over to a smaller plane, a C-32, and gets back on that other smaller plane. Secretary Pete Hegseth walks up the external stairs to that C-32, making it look like he's the senior official aboard. Mm-hmm. And then in sequence, those planes fly to Britain with the larger plane carrying the Air Force One call sign, despite the president not being aboard. And then everybody gets back on the new jet from Qatar in Britain to fly back to the United States.
Okay, a lot of questions here. The first one is this. What do we know about the threat from Iran that prompted all of this? Do you have a sense of how immediate or specific it was?
We know, and it has been reported by a couple outlets in the last month or so, that there was a specific threat that triggered a number of concerns. I don't have great fidelity on what would have prompted these sorts of really evasive maneuvers to try and protect the president.
I mean, this is a really elaborate sort of operation. I mean, the staff and our fellow reporters who are on board Air Force One were essentially part of the scheme, part of this decoy. Did they know that there was a threat?
No. You know, our reporting would bear out that at the bare minimum, the vast majority, can't necessarily speak for all of them, but a majority of the press corps did not know. And in fact, continued to report it wrong over the last couple of weeks, with public understanding not really holding anything until the last day.
Remind us, if you can, where this fits into the ongoing conversation about security concerns with the new Qatar-provided Air Force One.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the questions this whole thing has raised again is that this newer plane was not initially built to be both a VIP jet, but also a military aircraft, something that has countermeasures, something that could perhaps throw flares, something that would be, in a way, able to protect the president should they face incoming drone fire, missile fire, something like that. They have vaguely alluded to it receiving upgrades, but the specifics of that have been left out of the public square. And that there are some legitimate operational concerns there in terms of security, that withholding some of those details is not a surprise.
I mean, this is a sweeping national security story, but it's also a story about government transparency. We've heard Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal calling for a congressional briefing on the incident. And I wonder, how unusual is it for the White House to deliberately mislead both the press and the public about where the president is?
Certainly, it's rare. The closest thing that came to mind was President Bill Clinton flying into Pakistan on a plane that flew in after Air Force One in sequence. But in that case, he got off the plane immediately in plain view. It became very apparent within minutes of him landing. And the news coverage and the public understanding at the time, really within the day, within the hour of him landing in Pakistan, the leads of those stories all suggested, you know, a decoy was involved in getting him there.
And how has the White House responded to your reporting?
It's been muted so far. You know, they released a statement to the Post initially, and then other outlets that have confirmed, basically defending the new aircraft, suggesting the new aircraft is capable and, you know, has what it needs. They alluded to there being a variety of ways that they need to protect the president. They did not get into specifics, and they also denied nothing.
That was Dan Lamothe. He's a national security reporter at The Washington Post. Thank you and your colleagues so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
It's a tough time for anyone trying to buy their first home. Prices are high. Mortgages keep getting more expensive. Home sales that were already sluggish drop further in July. But million-dollar homes are selling quickly. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the two-speed housing market.
Sales of existing homes fell by 1.7% last month. A lot of would-be buyers are feeling priced out of the market now that mortgage rates have climbed to their highest level in a year, nearly 6.7%. Nashville realtor Jack Gaughan says each time interest rates tick up, buyers have to rethink how much home and where they can afford to buy.
It just makes it where there's so much uncertainty, especially for those newer, younger buyers who are already probably overly anxious about the thought of making such a large purchase. It kind of maybe will make you think twice before doing it.
Earlier this year, mortgage rates briefly dipped below 6%, sparking hopes of a housing rebound. But then the war with Iran triggered a spike in inflation, and mortgage rates started climbing again. That's especially challenging for first-time buyers, whose share of home purchases shrank last month. Senior economist Charlie Dougherty of Wells Fargo says the pain of rising interest rates is compounded by high sale prices. The average home sold for just over $434,000 last month. And Dougherty says the job market is softening, so family incomes are not keeping up.
It looks like the housing market is still on the mat, pinned down by really challenging affordability conditions.
It's a different story, however, at the upper end of the market, where sales of homes priced at $1 million or more are growing rapidly. Gaughan says the buyers eyeing those homes have often sold another house or are otherwise flush with cash, and they don't have to worry so much about rising interest rates.
It speaks to the wealth gap that we continue to see, where there's a lot of people just getting very, you know, wealthy these days, and that's great. And that means that there's a lot more luxury home seekers out there these days.
The overall housing market remains stuck in a slump, though. And that's a drag on other parts of the economy, like sales of furniture and appliances. Once inflation cools, it's possible mortgage rates will come down. But for now, market observers are not holding their breath. A survey by the National Association of Realtors found few agents expect much improvement in the number of buyers or sellers in the next 3 months. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
It is 529. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Klocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 8 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More info at klockobrewing.com. Patchy fog late tonight with lows 54 to 61.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. A person who was among those responding to the wildfires in the Superior National Forest suffered a medical emergency and died Tuesday. The Eastern Area Complex Incident Management Team reported the incident occurred about 10:40 a.m. near Ely. Fire personnel and emergency medical services responded. The patient was transported to a medical facility for treatment, but died after arrival. Officials say when there's more information available, they will provide an update. A news release from the Superior National Forest states, quote, "Our deepest condolences go out to the family and fellow firefighting community." A 70-year-old passenger died Monday in a two-vehicle crash on Business Highway 371 in Brainerd. The Brainerd Police Department responded to the crash at about 5:15 p.m. at the intersection with Greenwood Street. A vehicle driven by 79-year-old Rodney L. Knowles of Brainerd was southbound and turning onto Greenwood when it was struck by a northbound vehicle driven by Jesse L. Loggelin, 33, also of Brainerd. A passenger in Knowles' vehicle, Paul J. Dolan of Brainerd, was pronounced dead at the scene. Knowles suffered significant injuries and was transported to Essentia Health St. Joseph's Medical Center in Brainerd. Loggelin suffered minor injuries. The crash remains under investigation. St. Louis County's three newest public works facilities are now equipped with a 40-kilowatt solar array on each roof. The solar panels were produced locally by Helene in Mountain Iron. Their installation was supported by $336,000 in grants from the Minnesota Department of Commerce's statewide Solar on Public Buildings program. Each solar array is capable of producing 55 megawatts of electric energy annually, which is expected to cover nearly three-quarters of the facility's electrical energy usage. This estimation takes into account average snowy and cloudy days at each location, according to the county. The energy generated equates to a reduction in approximately 18 metric tons of carbon emissions annually for all three buildings. These three public works garages were completed in 2024. The roofs were designed with the intent to add solar panels once funding was available. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has completed a project to install three new arch culverts over water crossings along the Stony River Grade State Forest Road in Finland State Forest. The road is now open to the public. The agency says the arch culverts are efficient and cost-effective, and they replace undersized pipe culverts. They're designed to withstand high water flow during flood events. Their design also maintains the stream bed, providing a natural passage for fish and other aquatic life during low or high water. In 2022 and 2024, heavy rainfall events damaged the previous crossings, creating prolonged road closures that affected access to public land, local traffic, and access for emergency vehicles. Located near George H. Crosby Manitou and Teteguch State Parks, the nearly 312,000-acre Finland State Forest is a popular destination for trout fishing, camping, fall leaf viewing, and other recreation opportunities. The Minnesota Department of Revenue is hosting a series of public listening sessions with the stated goal of finding meaningful ways to support property taxpayers. The sessions are taking place from August to October. They will examine the state's property tax system and explore recommendations to make the system more understandable, accessible, and accountable to taxpayers. One of these meetings is planned for 1 to 2:30 p.m. Thursday and is available to attend virtually. Find more information on how to register at kaxe.org. The Minnesota Department of Transportation is inviting the public to attend a public meeting next Tuesday, August 18th at the Minnesota North College Rainy River Commons area to learn more about the recommended alternative for the Highway 11 and 71 corridor in International Falls. The study area is between the intersection of Couchiching County Road 91 and Highway 53. MnDOT will host the event at 5 p.m. with a short presentation at 5:15. The project team will be available to hear feedback and answer questions. That's it for the Up North Report. Happy primary election day. Check out our election guide at kaxe.org/election guide. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, made with psyllium, a plant-based fiber that helps support digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Designed to be taken every day. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Carnegie Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Of the six states holding primary elections today, a lot of the national attention is on Wisconsin. That's where a self-described Democratic socialist is in contention for governor. A win in a swing state like Wisconsin could build on a series of primary wins for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. But some people worry it could also add up to losses in November. To hear more, we've checked in with Mayon Silver from member station WUWM in Milwaukee. Hi, Mayon.
Hi there.
Okay, so tell us more about this candidate we're referring to. This is State Representative Francesca Hong, right?
Yeah, it is. So Hong is really firing up a devoted base. She's 37 years old. She's a single mother, a state lawmaker, who's worked as a bartender, a restaurant owner, and a chef. Here's part of her message on Instagram, touting that she's not bought by corporations.
And I'll tax the rich to fully fund our public schools and cut property taxes for free childcare and healthcare you can actually afford. And that's just a start.
Yeah, so that's a lot of promises, but her approach to centering working people has really resonated with voters. Like Rachel Swadowski, who I met at a farmer's market. She loves Hong's approach.
Too many people are just complacent and doing the same old, whatever benefits the well-to-do, not the average person.
If Hong's elected, she'd be the state's first woman and first Asian American governor. But a lot of Democrats have concerns.
Like what kinds of concerns?
So she has some controversial posts on social media from about 5 years ago, where she called for defunding or even abolishing the police.
Uh-huh.
She's backed away from this and other posts about canceling Thanksgiving or criticizing Valentine's Day. She's also rallied with left-wing streamer Hassan Piker. He's made comments some Jewish organizations have condemned as anti-Semitic. She said she appeared with him to reach new audiences. Hmm. At the market, another voter was concerned about Hong, Kathy Shore, from the Milwaukee suburbs.
She scares me. I mean, I consider myself a Democrat, I consider myself a liberal, but there's a line, and I definitely think she wants to cross it.
Democratic leaders have been divided about who they're supporting.
Okay, so then who are Hong's opponents here in this race?
So there are three other Democrats. Hong's main opponent, according to polling, appears to be David Crowley. He's county executive for the state's largest, most urban and diverse county, Milwaukee. If elected, he'd be the state's first Black governor. He actually dropped out of the race in early July when his campaign was struggling. But then when another moderate dropped out, Crowley got back in, and he got the key support from Democratic Governor Tony Evers as centrist Democrats were getting worried about Hong. Here's some of Crowley's message.
I am David Crowley, backed by Governor Tony Evers, by Labor, and progressives all across the great state of Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's a close swing state, and Winning usually requires getting votes from independents. And whichever Democrat wins, they'll likely face Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany, who has Trump's endorsement and a united Republican backing.
That is Mayon Silver from member station WUWM. Thank you so much, Mayon.
Thank you.
In Puerto Rico, the government started rationing water last week. It's cutting service to homes on a rotating schedule. The island is in a drought, but its water crisis is not new. In one building in San Juan, residents have been dealing with dry faucets for months, as NPR's Adrian Florido reports.
The tidy three-story condo building on Pomarosa Street lost reliable water service about a year ago. Many days, like today, they get none. Other days, there's just enough water pressure for a trickle to reach the first floor, where Sonia Palacios lives.
That's when I fill my water for the bathrooms and for the plants and for all of the other uses.
You bring out some plastic containers that just stand here while the container fills up from the trickle? How long does that take?
Well, how does that? A lot.
We sit on her back patio, surrounded by wilting plants.
To not have water, it's like a handicap. I feel like there's nothing I can do.
She can't really cook, wash dishes, or do laundry. She often bathes by scooping water out of a bin. She and the 9 other families in her building have rearranged their lives around their faucets.
Do you sometimes just walk by the sink or the shower, turn on the faucet just to see?
Yeah. Yes.
Every morning, every night.
A few of Palacios' neighbors have slid into her patio and are listening in. This is Norma Peña.
First thing we do when we wake up is go and check the faucet. If you go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, you go check the faucet. And second, if there is some water, you go to the chat and let everybody know there's water, at least in the first floor.
When that text message arrives, the families up on the third floor come downstairs to their neighbors' patios and fill their jugs from garden hoses.
They know. They need no permission if there's water.
Norma Peña takes me up to visit a resident of the third floor.
Ligi
Rios is 72 years old. Her little terrace is full of jugs, most of them empty.
Como tú ves, estas son mis botellitas. Ya está todo vacío. Aquí queda algo. Pero lo hemos usado todo con la esperanza de que mañana tenga.
She's made a gamble to use most of her stored water, she says, in the hopes there'll be running water tomorrow. Rios does not believe the government's explanation that this is all because of the drought.
Esto es pura corrupción.
It's pure corruption, Rios says, an opinion many Puerto Ricans share. El Niño has turned this summer into Puerto Rico's driest in more than a century. But the crisis has been made worse because the government has let the island's pipes deteriorate for decades. Its own data shows that 60% of the island's treated water is lost through leaks. Governor Jennifer Gonzalez's office did not respond to a request for comment, but she has publicly said that water cuts will continue until rain replenishes reservoirs and that officials are working to improve infrastructure. Another neighbor, Yomadil Caban, has her doubts.
This government does not give any maintenance a priority.
Caban's daughter, Pollyanna, is in the 11th grade.
We need water. It's essential to do anything.
She often doesn't know if she'll get a shower before school.
So it really changes your habits and, like, your structure, day-to-day life.
Norma Peña takes me back into her apartment. We check the taps. There's just a tiny little gurgle, but nothing came out. What about the shower? It sounded like a little burp.
Uh-huh.
It wanted to come out, but nothing came out. She's used blue masking tape to seal 2 of her family's 3 toilets shut.
Because it's almost like having a latrine in your house. And it's very unhealthy having that, so we have to manage that constantly.
And in the kitchen, after she or her husband boil an egg, they let the water cool for the dog.
See, porque you have to reuse the water, especially the one used for cooking.
What's his name?
This is Luna.
Luna, her name, so she drinks egg-flavored water sometimes.
See? Yes. Maybe even us.
One apartment building, 10 families navigating Puerto Rico's water crisis, drinking egg-flavored water and finding other creative ways to use every drop they get. Adrian Florido, NPR News, San Juan, Puerto Rico. We'll be right back.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. School begins tomorrow in the country's second largest school district, with one big difference from past years. There are sweeping new limits on screen time for students. The new rule in the Los Angeles School District comes just a few years after a major push there to bring technology into the classroom. NPR Sequoia Carrillo talked to LA educators about how they're dealing with the shakeup.
Armughan Khan is heading back to school for the eighth time as a middle school science teacher.
The beginning of every year has its own sort of anxiety attached to it, but I'm always excited.
This year brings a new kind of challenge for him and his colleagues at Cochrane Middle School. They're going old school, turning off the computers and putting away screens.
This is going to be a big impact for me. As a science teacher, technology is kind of the backbone of my curriculum.
While they were on summer vacation, the Los Angeles Unified School District passed a resolution to limit screen time for all of its students. It's part of a nationwide discussion in states and school districts about how much time students spend looking at devices. Many districts in some states have passed similar limits this year, but the rapid rollout in LA for its more than 400,000 students is unique. Starting this week, first grade and under will have no screen time. And starting in November, the rest of elementary school will have limits, with middle and high school students following later in the year.
I would say about 75% of our work was on some kind of screen-based activity.
Not only because his students can perform large-scale experiments on their laptops, like a car crash simulator to understand things like Newtonian forces, but also, it's because it's his best option. He has a space for in-person experiments, but no budget for them.
I don't feel like I'm being set up for success.
We know that there's no perfect solution in how to roll out to a school district the size of ours, right?
That's the district's chief academic officer, Pia Sadakotmal. She's overseeing the screen time change and says this year is a transition year.
We have one of the first school districts in the nation to adopt a policy at this scale. So we know that we are going to be learning along the way at each phase and incorporating those learnings as we roll out the next group of students.
Students will have software on their personal tablets or computers that will keep track of the amount of screen time used per week. Certain things are exempt, like virtual textbooks, but teachers are still trying to figure out where everything else fits.
I have more questions than I do sort of immediate concerns around it.
That's Kirti Baranwal, a longtime librarian at Clinton Middle School.
I think generally screen time limits are good, right? Like, we just don't want kids on screens all the time.
Last year, the district banned cell phones, a growing standard for many states around the country. So Baranwal did a lesson on screen addiction and asked her students to report their own screen time. Many came back with 8 or 10 hours a day, even with the ban in place.
I was like, when are you sleeping? Like, what is happening?
She says for kids who don't have the resources to play on sports teams or attend arts programs, their time outside of school is occupied often by their phone. She, like Khan in his science classroom, thinks just cutting things out only ends up leaving holes.
Like, okay, we don't want kids on phones. What is it that we want kids doing?
The Los Angeles School District is trying to figure that out. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Steve and Carissa are your hosts for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. You can rev up KAXE with your car, truck, or boat donation. It is quick and easy, and your unwanted vehicle will be towed away for free. Visit kaxe.org/cars to start your car donation. Thanks so much for your support. Mostly cloudy tonight, patchy fog late, lows 54 to 61, and tomorrow, our highs 77 to 81, mostly sunny, light northwest wind, Lows tomorrow night, mid-50s to low 60s. Patchy smoke is possible. And by Thursday, mostly sunny. Highs in the mid to upper 70s. If you would like to be an on-air DJ, KAXE is holding training for new volunteer DJs on Monday, August 24th at the KAXE studio in Grand Rapids from 6 to 7:30. You can send an email to volunteer@kaxe.org with any questions or to confirm your attendance. The Brainerd Ski Loons have their final show of the season tomorrow evening, 6:30 at Lum Park. Bring your own blanket or chair. And you can meet several local authors tomorrow at the Bemidji Public Library starting at 5 p.m. Learn about their writing journeys, explore a variety of books, and connect with fellow book lovers. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. There is more ahead from All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Since the 90s, Austin, Texas has proudly built itself as the live music capital of the world. But Austin is no longer the affordable college town that it was back then. Many musicians now struggle to make ends meet. As Olivia Aldridge at KUT in Austin explains, an advocacy group helps them get and pay for insurance, even as healthcare costs keep rising.
Yeah, what's up, everybody? How we doing?
Zach Morgan is a funk keyboardist in Austin. These days, he's pretty established. He plays with a bunch of bands around town. He's 38 and married and thinking about having a kid. But to get started on this path, he needed a big push. That came in 2015 when he lost his job in tech.
I was like, okay, well, maybe this is my sign to try the full-time music thing. Step one in that was like, get health insurance again.
Coming from the corporate world, it was intimidating to think about figuring out health benefits on his own. He found help from the nonprofit Health Alliance for Austin Musicians, or HAM.
That's part of being able to make this whole thing work, I think.
HAM subsidizes the monthly insurance premiums for thousands of musicians who buy plans through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. They partner with Central Health, a public agency that provides healthcare resources for low-income residents of Austin and surrounding Travis County. Together, they plan to spend about $4 million on the program this year. Rachel Blair is Chief Strategy Officer for HAM.
When you think about the average HAM member making about $30,000 a year, there's no way that they would be able to spend a third of their income on healthcare.
Here's how it's worked for the past decade. HAM members enroll in one of the plans that Central Health offers on the marketplace. And if they fall within a certain income range, they'll get a federal subsidy for part of the monthly premium. Central Health covers the rest. Musicians who don't quite fit in the income criteria, maybe because they make a little more, can still get about half their premium costs covered directly by HAM. Blair says musicians who are insured are healthier, and they don't have to worry as much about falling ill or getting in an accident while on the road.
That chronic stress erodes our health. It impacts creativity. It impacts a willingness to take a risk, to go out and be a creative entrepreneur, to be a musician, to put yourself out there in a very physical way.
HAM's work has become a model for other cities that have live music scenes. Some of them, like New Orleans and Nashville, also have programs for getting musicians health care. In Texas, HAM helped launch a similar program in Denton. That's where the University of North Texas has its top-rated music and arts schools. Roy Orbison, Nora Jones, Meatloaf, and others got their start in Denton.
There's a very long history of jazz, weird art rock. The visual arts community here is very strong.
That's Jennifer Kapanos, president of the Denton Music and Arts Collaborative. They want local musicians and artists to stick around.
More and more people were maybe graduating college and leaving and going to find better opportunities other places.
The Denton Group offers a subsidy of $100 a month to help local musicians and artists buy insurance. Back in Austin, the restaurant industry is another important part of the local economy. Central Health just started another partnership like HAM's to help insure waiters, cooks, and other food workers. Kit Abney-Spels with Central Health says they like to work with specific industries that already have networks they can tap.
I think some people believe that, oh, if you just say it, like, hey, you know,
free insurance for you that people will just come, and that's not always the case.
The model does have gaps. In most states, the very lowest income people are covered by Medicaid, not the marketplace plans. But Texas is one of 10 states that did not expand Medicaid, so those people can't get coverage through either option. Ham tries to help musicians in that situation get low-cost doctor's appointments when they can. And for people who do qualify, it's gotten more expensive. Insurance rates are rising everywhere, and Congress decided to cut back on subsidies for marketplace plans in 2026. Rachel Blair says Ham has had to turn people away. The percentage of Ham members who are insured dropped from 95 to 91% this year.
While it is a decrease, we feel really proud of being able to stay as high as we are, and we're working to get back as best we can.
In September, Ham will hold its yearly festival and fundraiser. Bands will play at grocery stores, parking lots, even on the steps of the Texas Capitol, doing their part to raise enough money to help pay for their health care in 2027. For NPR News, I'm Olivia Aldridge in Austin.
The story comes from NPR's partnership with KUT and KFF Health News.
It is a sad week for fans of Jackie and Shadow. They were, of course, the mated pair of bald eagles made famous by a video live stream of their nest high up in a pine tree in Big Bear, California, some 90 miles east of Los Angeles. Rescuers announced Jackie's death early Monday. From member station KVCR in San Bernardino, Madison Ament reports.
For 3 weeks, the female bald eagle had been in and out of intensive care at the Ojai Raptor Center in California. Center employees took her in after she was found on the ground near Big Bear Lake, about a mile from her nest in the San Bernardino Mountains. She's not banded, but the organization that ran the live stream says it's her. For at least a decade, Jackie delighted viewers who tuned into that live stream, which beamed her and her mate Shadow's eagle antics 24/7. Viewers got to see her lay eggs, watch them hatch, and see Jackie feed chicks like she is in this clip from April. Many of those viewers are mourning now. Ursula Denai, who lives in Los Angeles, has been following the Big Bear Eagles since 2020.
Yeah, this is a very personal thing. I feel like my old pet has passed, or a family member or a friend. It is consuming grief.
She says that watching the eagles helped her get through some really tough times in her life. Jackie had been found after fighting with two juvenile eagles. The Ojai Raptor Center said she was not injured in the fight, but was suffering from severe anemia. It's not clear what caused the illness. Jackie was estimated to be about 14. U.S. Fish and Wildlife says eagles can live up to about 30 years in the wild. Her condition improved, then got worse over the last week. Jenny Voisard is with Friends of Big Bear Valley, the nonprofit that runs the live stream. She says Jackie had a superpower.
Being able to connect so many different people across the world of different ages and different cultures.
Voisard says Jackie helped foster a love of nature for fans all over the world, and that legacy will continue. Jackie leaves behind Shadow, her mate of almost a decade, and several eaglets, including Luna and Sandy. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament in San Bernardino.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, now offering MyPhone, a modern home phone service for families who want a screen-free experience with parental controls like Trusted Circle and Quiet Hours. More at MyPhone.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing real stories with supporting data through its podcast After the Fact, exploring how people find solutions to some of today's biggest issues. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, made with psyllium, a plant-based fiber that helps support digestive health by trapping and removing waste, designed to be taken every day. Learn more at Metamucil.com. and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We operate translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Since 1976, Northern Community Radio has been telling the story of the people and the land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. Keep KAXE people powered into the future with your support now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Support comes from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More